Hi, this is Tessa from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 18. Enjoy the show.
Thanks, Andrew. I think I'm in a comfortable, friendly crowd, I think. One of the fantastic things about a conference like this is the fact that it is a conference not based on our past training or specialty focus, but on our present and future interests in the care of children. And I know all of us are here because we do love children, we do love caring for them, and we want to be better at it, we want to be good at it, we want to be excellent at it. Even for, you know, it's been really nice as well, you know, to see all the Twitter superstars like Andrew and Victoria and everyone else here. It's really, really nice. Now, I'm a minority here. I'm an ENT surgeon. I'm a very simple surgeon. I have three simple passions in life: the ear, the nose, and the throat. So I'm grateful that last year Andy invited me to talk on ear, nose, and throat, and I was really happy. You know, I was sad that it was only 18 minutes, but I was happy that I got a chance to talk about ENT. This year, Andy invited me to talk about my other passion outside of the ear, the nose, and the throat, which is our health as clinicians. And this is a topic that again and again has become quite foremost and forefront in the mind of a lot of us, and we know that. And I've got to be honest with you, there is nothing new that you're going to hear from me today. Everything that you will hear today are things that I'm sure you have thought about, you have considered. It's preaching to the converted, it's preaching to the choir. The fact that you're here means that you're actually interested in matters that concerns mental health in ourselves as clinicians and in our team members as fellow workers. So, you know, when we look back at what we do, you know, in a conference like this where we cross specialty boundaries, we talk a lot about in all the other sessions about how to care better for our patients, how to care better for our team members. This session, we're just going to look inward a bit on how to care better for each other, for ourselves individually. Okay. I wanted to title this session, Being Human in Healthcare. But I realize we cannot do medicine alone. It's not safe for us. It's not safe for our patients. And I'm just going to take that straight from what Dr. Victoria Brazil have spoken about just in the earlier session, which is we want to do things better together. So, you know, just this morning I added the word together there, and I'm grateful that Victoria is, you know, kind of impressed on that on us, that we just cannot do medicine on our own. We cannot do medicine alone. We have to do it together and better. Being human together in healthcare. Now, we know that being a clinician, and it doesn't mean a doctor, it means a nurse, social worker, healthcare worker in general. Being a clinician in today's practice is very different to what it used to be in the past. We are no longer, you know, a direct, you know, there's no longer what I call a doctor-patient relationship. As a doctor, advocate, legal person, administrator, a theater operations manager, you know, ethics people, they have taken a huge part in what we do on a day-to-day basis. How we practice medicine today is very different to what it was 20 years ago. It used to be that we could just write on a note, patient needs to go to theater, patient needs this and that, and it happens. But nowadays, you know, I have to go, you know, all these people in the picture all have to log into a computer, have to find a computer, have to go through the 7 passwords, and then have to go, you know, you get what I mean, you get what I mean. The way we practice medicine today is very different. When Andy last year spoke about his journey with mental health, I remember that very clearly because we were all transfixed, we were all moved by his experience. We could hear a pin drop on the carpet at Brisbane Convention Centre. We remember that because we identified with his story. You know, as we went through our medical training, nursing training, and all of that, I felt a similarity with what, you know, Andy felt. You know, I'm here as an ENT surgeon, not because I'm an expert in mental health issues, but because just like you. I'm somebody who has been into those dark places. And my work affects me mentally, and my mental health affects my work. And you know that. There's nothing new about that. When I go through my surgical training, I felt that I have lost three significant things, and I wrote that a little bit, you know, just like a millennial surgeon, I wrote a blog, you know, to try and pour out my emotions. I talked about three losses, which is firstly a loss of control, secondly a loss of support, and thirdly a loss of meaning. A loss of control on a day-to-day basis. We don't control our days. We are often, you know, whatever comes in through the door will control our life. My pager controls our life. I've been on call for the last 24 hours, and my day today has just turned out very different from what I planned, you know, just at 7 a.m. this morning. We don't have real control over our day-to-day things. During training, you are, you know, sent to different places, and every time you move, every 3 months or 6 months or a year, you're taking away your social support. You know, you miss your anniversaries, you miss your family holidays, you miss your birthdays of your children. So we've lost our control, we've lost our support. You know, no longer can I expect to operate on a particular patient on a particular day, because that is controlled by the bookings officer, you know. All of that can be tackled and handled, but it's the loss of meaning that I think hits home the hardest. What we train for in medicine and surgery and nursing and allied health was to care for patients. But the system that we work in today expects us to do more than that. We need to be data entry managers, we need to be patient advocate, we need to be a lot of things in so many roles and different things. And I think that puts a lot of pressure on us, and that affects us. You know these numbers very clearly, and almost as if you can just rattle it off. There's 12,000 doctors and medical students in Australia, Beyond Blue, over a few years ago. So one in five of us have actually been diagnosed with depression, either today or in the past. Some has been managed, some hasn't been managed, but essentially there has been a diagnosis of depression made. So if one of five of us, which means that, you know, in every role there is somebody or one or two that had been diagnosed with depression. We know that data, and that's an Australian data. One in four have actually thought about suicide. Again, in every role, there would be two or three persons who may have considered suicide. And more worryingly, one in about 50 have attempted suicide. So in a conference this size, there would be somebody sitting in this conference that would have actually seriously considered or attempted suicide. And these numbers are real data from Australian statistics, and therefore in a typical nursing, surgical, emergency, pediatric department, there will be somebody who has been diagnosed with depression who may have actually attempted suicide. And those are real numbers. But there's that question about, again, whenever we talk about mental illness, often the word burnout is thrown in. What's the difference between mental illness, such as depression, and a condition called burnout? A lot of people are using those terms interchangeably. And psychiatrically speaking, or you know, looking at the literature, we have to be very careful with the use of those two. So depression is a DSM-5 ICD-10 category. There are eight factors. You need to fulfill five out of those eight, and it's a persistent condition. Whereas burnout is a psychological state that is characterized by three things, and I'm just going to put that out there. Emotional exhaustion, low professional efficacy, and high cynicism, or essentially depersonalization. Now, depression is a mental illness that requires mental illness strategies. Burnout is a psychological condition. It is not a mental illness diagnosis. And we have to be very careful in understanding the interplay between the two. The answer to everything is not that he or she is depressed. There might be other factors around the working environment that may play a part in that depression, but the depression is not always the answer to everything. And again, similarly, burnout is not the answer to everything. When somebody is feeling low, it might not just be burnout because of occupational stressors, but there might actually be an underlying mental illness that needs to be diagnosed. And just to be very clear, if you do have a mental illness diagnosis, the best thing that you can do is to have a strong GP advocate and a strong mental health professional to assist you in that area. the best thing that we can do as the rest of us who work with somebody with mental illness is to normalize and accept. If one in five of our department has diabetes, what do? We will make sure that each other's blood sugar levels will be normal. We will make sure that it will take breaks. We won't do long 12-hour-long operations or 12-hour shifts without a break. We would accept that if one in five of us have got something like diabetes, we would accept that and normalize that. And one in five of us do have depression. And so we should just accept that and normalize that and actually work towards accepting that as a condition that can be managed well. And you know doctors who are functioning very effectively with a well-managed mental illness. You know these people. But about burnout, that's another elephant altogether, I should say. There are institutional causes to burnout that we as a group may need to consider and tackle. Which physicians are most burned out? I'm not sure if there are any emergency medicine physicians here, but top of the line emergency medicine physicians are most burnout. This is from an American study, 14,000 doctors last year, Medscape. Now, we have to take it with a pinch of salt. This is self-reporting, and people just answer surveys. But it's 14,000, and this is an American data, so it's worth thinking. Of course, right at the top is emergency medicine, and just a few down the line, halfway in the middle, is pediatrics. I'm doing not so good as well. Plastic surgery and otolaryngology ranks reasonably high in terms of burnout. What are the causes of burnout in, just to take the pediatric group, what are the causes of burnout in pediatrician? You know this, too many bureaucratic tasks, too much paperwork, spending too many hours at work, long shifts, feeling like you're just a cog in the system. I'm sure we've all experienced that. And increasing computerization of practice. I don't know if any one of you have struggled with that as well, but these are some of the main reasons why people feel or experience that emotional exhaustion, that reduced effectiveness, and that depersonalization or high cynicism. And just remember, this is a cost to the hospital financially and a cost to the hospital from a safety point of view. When you have half of your doctors in your department not working effectively because of burnout or poorly managed mental health, you're gonna have a team or a unit that is not functioning at their best because they're not effective, they're burnt out. So we need to pay attention to some of these as well. And this is the World Medical Association Geneva Pledge. For the first time, there's a very specific line that says, I will attend to my own health and well-being and abilities in order to provide care of the highest standard. So now it is embedded in our pledge as physicians or clinicians that not only do we look after patients, we look after ourselves as well. So in the last 7 minutes, I just want to talk about two simple studies and maybe three little actionable actions, that's a redundancy in itself. Actionable points that you might think about, things that you can do tomorrow when you return to your various departments. So the most recent advances in pediatrics actually brought this out, battling burnout. There are some strategies to promoting physician wellness. Without even reading the paper, what do you think are these strategies? Rest, exercise, meditation and mindfulness. Finding better colleagues. That's right, finding better colleagues. But the two important thing that was being brought out is number one, finding meaning in your work, and number two, developing strong social support network. And then comes all of that meditation, mindfulness, and things like that. Just remember that resilience training is not the answer to everything. Okay, but that's when it comes to burnout. Okay, remember, mental illness, depression, we need to support each other to find good, accountable clinicians to help us in our mental health care. But with regards to battling burnout, institutional factors need to be considered. Sure glad the hole isn't at our end. Sometimes when we think about this problem, we often think of it and frame it in an individual thing. So you're not performing effectively, therefore you've got mental illness. You go and fix the problem yourselves. we need to think of it as an institutional team-based thing. And I think the gestalt of a conference like this, when we break down barriers, when we break down institutional or specialty differences, is about being better together as an institution, as a group, crossing specialties, ensuring that we deliver the best care to each other and therefore for the sake of our patients ultimately. Executive Leadership and Physician Well-being is another landmark paper. In summary, it reports 9 strategies that an institution can do. Resilience training is only one of them. The other 8 refers to institutional methods. It is worth looking at this paper because it details some of the burnt-out measurements, some of the measurements or KPIs or quality control markers that an institution can take or do on a yearly or 6-monthly basis to measure the health of an institution, to measure the health of a team, to measure the performance of a team from the point of view of an institutional health and well-being. So I've only got 3 little things to end with. And those 3 things start with the letter C. Just for easy to remember. The first thing is the core. So what can we do tomorrow when we return to our institutions? And you've heard me share this before in the past probably. The first thing is core, finding your core. Now again and again when it comes to burnout and depression, one of the most important thing that has been identified is the fact that clinicians lose the meaning in their work. Now, we have the best job in the world, don't we? We look after patients, we look after each other, we look after children who are unwell, we help the family get better. We have the best job in the world. We also have the worst job in the world to a certain extent in terms of the pressure that we experience. But we have the best job in the world. Now, finding our core is critical to managing or battling that burnout. Now, that core, to me, might be different than that core to you. And there's an interesting study in that study that I put up as well. When we talk about a 20% core, if you spend 20% of your week or your working time devoted to doing things that you find meaningful, your job satisfaction is going to be very high. And that reaches a ceiling level, meaning if you devote 40% of meaningful work, your job satisfaction is going to be similar. To take that in reverse, you can do 80% paperwork and 20% meaningful work, and you will actually get a high job satisfaction. Now, that meaningful work to you or to me will be different. What I mean by that is for some, it will be teaching. For another person, it will be organizing a DFTB conference. For another person, it is operating or being an expert in a particular disease or being a scholar or being a simulation advisor. Very specific in that you find something that you find meaningful, you know, research, education, advocacy, patient care. If you spend and devote 20% of your working week to doing that, you're going to have a high job satisfaction. And that's good. That's good to know because it means that we can deal with the 80% of the mundane stuff that we do on a day-to-day basis. And that's what we found. That's what I mean by core. Just finding your core, finding that meaningful business that matters to you. Second thing is champion. Now, finding a champion in your department, you're here. You're champions already in the sense that you're interested in this matter. And coming to a conference like this, you're already, you know, champions of change. Because you are interested in breaking down specialty barriers or specialty silos to communicate better with people from other teams or other tribes or other communities. So tap the champion on the shoulder and say, look, you know, let's think about doing this, let's think about doing that, and find simple, practical methods that works in your department that will look different to those solutions in other departments. And finally, culture. In terms of culture, again, the gestalt of all that we've talked about in conferences like this is changing the culture to be a safe, positive working environment for each other so that we can deliver the best care for our patients. And I'll stop at that. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks very much, Eric. And I think one of the things that resonated with me more than anything else was the concept that finding meaning in what you do, finding that happiness, and also creating a strong social support network. And that's one of the ethos is really behind what we do here. And I hope that when you all leave here, you've all found a better social support network for you. Now, I did forget to introduce someone on the stage here. You may see I've got someone just sitting to my right. This is Becky Singer. She'll be our Twitter moderator this morning. But does anyone on the floor have any questions for Eric?
Andrew McDonald from Campbelltown. The most confronting thing I think most of our house staff have to do is the morning handover between 8 and 9, which is sometimes quite confronting and sometimes quite critical. Do you have any advice for those who do handover how to make it more like you've described?
Oh, I still have nightmares of handing over a trauma team, you know, and when I've been on call and in the morning getting grilled and roasted by a whole department full of men in suits. Sorry. It's one of those interesting things. I think culture can be bottom-up, but it can also be top-down. And what I mean by that is if the senior leadership at the senior rank somehow creates a culture of safety and safe communication, I mean, the data is out there that, you know, terrible communication results in terrible performance, results in poor patient care. The data is clear about that. And when you have a leadership group or key people in leadership areas or senior leaders, seniors, not necessarily leaders, but seniors who are well respected within the team, changes that culture of communication, the effect seems to travel down much quicker than if it was a bottom-up kind of approach. And of course, we stand here because, you know, I've had a personal experience of a colleague who's committed suicide, and I'm sure many of you in this room have know people in that situation. Although it is not technically a trainee problem, this is, you know, a consultant level issue as well. There are people who struggle with it as well. It crosses gender, it crosses specialties, it crosses seniority level. But I think the bottom line to your question, or answering your question directly, I think a cultural change, hopefully from a top-down level, would actually make the change much faster or speedier than it is to expect a junior person to effect change. Any thoughts, Andy, or from yourself?
No, I think I'll just pass it on.
Yeah. I'm always interested in specific and practical examples, so I just wondered, no pressure, if you have a practical example from your own team of something that helped with wellness and burnout and mental health.
So it's interesting. So I've worked in, I've done three fellowships in three different countries, and each of them were very, very different in terms of practical stuff that worked. When I was in Canada, they provided a lot of money, not a lot, I should say, that, but real practical money for their resident society to go and spend a week somewhere elsewhere, you know, like just go and enjoy yourself. For some reason, that really was quite important for them. In another fellowship, there's something called the Swartz Rounds. So it is a weekly meeting where anyone can just come in, and it's a kind of a closed door meeting where you talk about the things that you've gone through clinically that has affected you negatively. And there is always a counselor in that group that would just walk through that group. And just that vulnerability of sharing has been powerful in allowing people to be vulnerable and yet at the same time to feel safe. Swartz Round. If you Google that up, it's available, and there's a lot of data everywhere. And again, I pointed to that second paper. There were very specific kind of a practical advice on all of that, and I didn't want to fill a whole slide with that. Yeah, but those are two examples that has worked.
Thanks very much, Eric. And we'll just take one more question from the floor.
This is just a comment. So I went to the compassion workshop the other day, and one of the practical things that I took away from that was doing a brief guided meditation at the beginning of handover.
Perfect. Yep.
So, you know, just so that everybody approaches it with a kind heart rather than a critical one.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much, Eric.
Thanks.